What is the NAB and how did it get so much power? That was a topic addressed in a teach-in on the NAB and media also held during the week of protests. Next, some highlights from that discussion as we hear from Mark Lloyd, a former attorney for the broadcast industry who is now a public interest advocate in the area of broadcast media.
The National Association of Broadcasters is arguably the most powerful lobbying force in the country. And they're powerful for a couple of reasons. They're powerful because they have a lot of money to spend. They're also powerful because they're broadcasters. Unlike the gun lobby, unlike the tobacco lobby, the broadcasters control images and words and stories. We've heard a great deal about gun control and the debate about gun control. We've heard a great deal about the tobacco industry and what's good and bad about the tobacco industry. And there's no question that these forces have an incredible amount of power on the Hill and a great amount of power to, you know, put advertising on the air. But their power is not the air. The broadcasters didn't tell you about the Telecommunications Act of 1996, and that's an incredible amount of power. The 1996 Telecommunications Act was 2 years at least in the making. The seeds of it began long before 1996, and really before 1994, because folks began to understand convergence and that all of these industries were really becoming one. And they weren't quite sure what that meant, essentially, to their financial stake. In other words, Lawrence Tisch and folks at GE and others understood that their way of making money was changing. And so they had a stake very early on in trying to control the rules about their industry, because obviously they have a stake in how they make money. What happened in 1996? In 1996, we've got essentially a Republican-controlled Congress, both houses. While they had been working on this act for 2 years prior, they could never come to agreement about things, essentially because the forces that needed to be in agreement were not necessarily in control. Once the Republicans had control of both houses of Congress, they met with the folks in the Senate, and they presented what their compromise was. Now, their compromise is not just the NAB's compromise. It's, and I think Nicole suggested this, it really was the compromise between the broadcasters, the telephone folks, and the cable folks. Those groups got together, and then they came up with a compromise. And behind closed doors, there was a meeting on a date certain, and they came out of that meeting with an agreement. Public interest advocates in Washington were quite upset because we weren't invited to the meeting. No one could possibly have expected that. But what came out of that was the 1996 Telecommunications Act. And what happened after that was that the act was passed by, as Nicole said, very large margins in both houses and signed with a great deal of fanfare and ceremony by President Clinton and Al Gore, who was considered to be in some ways the father of it and is in some ways the father. And we were told that this was going to be good for consumers because there would be increased competition between these companies, that the telephone companies would provide you with television pictures, and that the cable companies would provide you with telephone service. Right? This is what they were talking about, you know, from roughly 1994 to 1996, because that's what convergence means, right? Bell Atlantic spent, you know, millions of dollars trying to figure out how they could deliver really interactive video services, because they were going to get in the television business and the cable business. That's what this was about. But the compromise that they struck really was to release caps on ownership so that what we have now is not competition from these industries with each other, but having these industries buy each other up. Which is why, of course, you have Time, Warner, AOL. Which is why you had AT&T buy TCI, which was the largest cable company. All right? So what you see here is you see companies that were in competing industries, because of the 1996 Act, they are able to buy those industries. So they're not competing, they're consolidating. Now, this part of the Act wasn't reported by Dan Rather and Peter Jennings and Tom Brokaw or Jim Lehrer, NBC, or, you know, America's most trusted anchor, whose program, by the way, is sponsored by Rupert Murdoch and a few others. This is what we have. I spent most of my life as a broadcast producer and reporter, working mainly in commercial broadcasting, mainly television, working in the Midwest at local stations, working at NBC and working at CNN. I did a lot of non-commercial work as well. After that, I went to law school, and I did graduate, and represented broadcast companies before the FCC, working with the NAB. And there are a couple of important things I'd like to tell you about the National Association of Broadcasters. First, think about the name. The National Association of Broadcasters. That includes television and radio. It includes NPR and nonprofit and non-commercial stations. It includes commercial stations. It includes networks. It includes large and small. There's a great deal of division within the NAB, with radio people fighting television people, with network people fighting local stations. They are not one body, but they are a collective and an association, and that's the most important thing that you need to understand about them. Because they understand that even though the networks say, we're going to charge you, the affiliate, extra money to carry our network programs, they stay in the same association. Even though you have radio folks and television folks competing sometimes for the same ad dollars, they stay in the same association. Because there's one thing that they have in common, despite their very real differences and heated differences at their meetings, and that is their control over the public airwaves so they can continue to make money. They are an association with a common interest and a clear purpose. They are not scattered. Their principal is making money. Though they have agreements, they keep together. They are very focused, and they are extraordinarily well-funded. The power of the NAB comes not only from their money, and I'll talk a little bit about their money, but the power, again, as I suggested in my first remarks, also comes from the fact that the members of their association have direct control over images and have direct control over the ability of politicians who create the rules to talk to you. Am I clear? Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, they have to buy television time and radio time to get you to vote for them. All right, so imagine this. You've got money from the NAB, direct contributions. Then you have lobbyists from the NAB arguing their issues. And then you've got local broadcasters going to the people who make the votes saying, you know, we're not going to tell you, you know, one thing or the other, but we want to tell you that we care about this. And the NAB sends out packets to each of the local broadcasters to make sure that they know how to communicate effectively with the local leaders. Because that's who goes. It's not just the lobbyists at the NAB. It's their money. It's the lobbyists. It's also the local broadcasters going to your representatives. And the member of Congress, what they hear and see is not only money that they've got to buy more ads on radio and television, and lobbyists who are making very good, strong legal arguments about what they ought to do, but also the local broadcaster who they've got to buy tithe from and who also makes a contribution to them, but also who puts their face and their words on the news. That's why the NAB is powerful. The NAB in 1999 spent $5.3 million lobbying members of Congress. $5.3 million lobbying members of Congress. In donations, the NAB spent $1.9 million contributing money to their coffers. Broadcasters rake in considerably more than that from politicians to put the campaigns on the air. You are dealing with an incredibly powerful force. They have a direct, several impacts on members of Congress, and guess what? They don't tell you what they're doing because they don't have to make it news, right? There's a line in the movie that says, "The greatest trick that the devil played on mankind was convincing mankind that he doesn't exist." The greatest trick that the broadcasters play on you is convincing you that they're not important and that they're not doing things against your interest.
Thank you.
That was public interest attorney Mark Lloyd. Next, we'll hear a history of the NAB from Richard Edmondson, who is the co-founder of San Francisco Liberation Radio and the author of a new book, Rising Up, Class War in America.
We're all here protesting, spending a whole week protesting the NAB, and I thought it might be useful to examine a little bit of the history of this organization. It's a history which began on a night in April in the year 1923 when 60 station owners from 12 states gathered together in the city of Chicago to discuss how they could get out of paying royalties to songwriters, composers, and other artists. The broadcasters vowed to take their argument, their case, all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they bolstered their argument with the claim that their radio stations weren't making any money. It was a disingenuous claim. While it is true that at that early stage in the history of broadcasting, many stations in America had not yet wholly begun to embrace this concept of airing paid commercials, yet it was also true that many of them were being used as promotional tools for other business interests that the stations, station owners own, such as department stores and the like. Well, this dispute between the NAB and the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers resulted in a victory for ASCAP. After several adverse court rulings, the broadcasters grudgingly began to pay up. This initial struggle waged by the NAB, however, was one of the last that the organization would ever lose, one notable exception to that being the fight in the late 1960s over whether or not to ban cigarette advertising over radio and TV. The NAB thankfully lost that struggle as well, but they haven't lost too many others. In a court affidavit filed in the Stephen Dunifer Free Radio Berkeley case, author Robert McChesney elaborates on how the 1934 Communications Act was passed with minimal public participation. With commercial broadcasters using their immense political power to see to it that no possibility existed for congressional hearings to be held prior to the legislations being passed. And as a result of that legislation, as well as the earlier 1927 Communications Act, all the profitable channels were handed over to the commercial broadcasters, while radio stations owned by colleges, universities, and labor unions began to dwindle and dry up and disappear. In 1961, the NAB was verbally lambasted by then-FCC Chairman Newton Minow. And Minow was kind of an interesting figure. At the age of just 35, he had been appointed by President Kennedy to head the FCC, and in a speech at the NAB's convention that year in Washington, Minow announced that he planned on holding public hearings in cities all across America whenever station licenses came up for renewal. And this was pretty unprecedented because station license renewals had just been automatic at that time. But Minow said that he wanted the people who own the airwaves, that's us, to act as informants for the FCC and to let the FCC know what's been going on and whether or not the broadcasters in their areas had been fulfilling their public service obligations. And Minow kind of summed up his view of the broadcast industry this way, paraphrasing, I think, Churchill. He said, "Never have so few owed so much to so many." Statements like this, as you might expect, earned Minow the overt hostility of the broadcast industry. Robert Sarnoff, head of NBC, branded Minow the purveyor of a dangerous, mistaken, illiberal doctrine, while Frank Stanton, head of CBS, claimed Minow had grossly distorted the situation, and both network heads praised what they referred to as the diversity of television, and both spoke in dire, ominous tones about the dangers of government censorship. Minow's tenure at the FCC, lasting just 2 short years, was marked by bitter frustration. A package of reforms he attempted to have implemented went down to a defeat so crushing it was described by New York Times columnist Tom Wicker as being the most complete rout the Kennedy administration has suffered in this congressional session. And Wicker went on to add that nobody who watched the fate of Minow's reforms would doubt the broadcast industry's ability to write its own ticket on Capitol Hill. And those words have certainly proven to be prophetic as we watched, as the other two panelists have elaborated, how the NAB virtually wrote its own ticket in 1996 with the passage of the Telecommunications Act. NAB conventions are largely exercises in corporate bestiality. Deals are made, politicians are corrupted. Actually, it might interest a lot of people here tonight to know that the first counter convention to an NAB convention was not held by the micro radio movement. In the early 1940s, there was a splinter breakaway group called the National Association of Independent Broadcasters, or NAIB, which felt that the NAB had become too heavily dominated by the networks. And in 1970, jumping ahead a few years, there was a group called the Chicago Journalism Review, which staged a protest and counter-convention to the NAB's convention that year in Chicago. The CJR counter-convention issued a statement basically affirming the principle that the airwaves belong to the public and denouncing the NAB for befouling the airwaves in the process of selling products which pollute the air, land, and water. Now, over across the street at the NAB convention that year, the mood was described by one delegate as militant for positive social change, you might ask. Well, no, not hardly. This militancy was directed at a rulemaking proposal at the FCC designed to break up the concentration of media ownership by limiting the cross-ownership of newspapers and broadcast media in a single city. One media baron of the time, Walter Annenberg, is perhaps illustrative. In the city of Philadelphia, Annenberg owned 2 of the major daily newspapers, 1 of 3 VHF TV stations, a powerful AM station, and an FM station. Plus, Annenberg also owned AM-FM TV combinations in the nearby cities of Altoona, Pennsylvania, and Binghamton, New York. The right of media monopolists to own as much of the airways as they can get their hands on. This is the kind of militancy specialized in by the NAB. All of that set the stage for the rise of the micro radio movement. And the FCC in the Bay Area and certainly in other places across the country, there was Free Radio Berkeley went on the air in April of 1993, followed a month later by our station here in San Francisco. 1993 was the year that former Mayor Frank Jordan unveiled his Matrix program, and at SFLR we used our little corner of the liberated airwaves to denounce the confiscation of homeless people's shopping carts, clothes, blankets, sleeping bags, as well as the arrests of Food Not Bombs activists for serving food to homeless people. But anyway, the FCC thought to put a stop to all of this illicit, unlicensed broadcast activity by seeking an injunction against Free Radio Berkeley founder Stephen Dunifer. This was in late 1994. And the NAB jumped on that bandwagon by filing a friend of the court brief in support of the FCC's decision. The FCC's decision at that time, keep in mind, was that Free Radio Berkeley, San Francisco Liberation Radio, Black Liberation Radio, all of us should just disappear and go away. Well, that friend of the court brief was pretty much corporate America's declaration of war on the micro radio movement. Dunifer and his attorneys had argued that the FCC should change their rules to allow stations of under 100 watts in power to broadcast. However, the NAB in its amicus brief stated, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it's pretty much close to the exact words that they use, that acceptance of Dunifer's arguments would jeopardize the entire regulatory framework carefully constructed by Congress in the 1934 Communications Act, and would undermine the diverse, vibrant system of free over-the-air broadcasting which FCC policies had made possible.
That was Richard Edmondson, co-founder of San Francisco Liberation Radio, speaking on a panel on the political influence of the NAB recorded last month in San Francisco.
Okay. It's the federal government. Hey, everybody, the government's here. Get our equipment. U.S. Marshals, okay? What do you want? Right? Okay.
You with Banna?
Yep.
Open the door for here for a second. I want to talk to you.
What do y'all want to talk to me about?
Got a survey order here.
Okay.
And what we're going to do is be seizing all your radio equipment.
Okay. What all that include?
Well, it'll say in the order. So
go on
in and have a seat.
Okay.
Get everybody gathered up in the
okay.
Washroom, please. This
was secure. Okay. Well, I'll tell you right now, the transmitter's upstairs.
Okay.
That's all you need.
Well, thank
ain't
you.
It?
I appreciate that.
They're upstairs.
Go on. Let's have everybody have a seat on the couch.
Okay. All right.
Before you sit down,
y'all know they're here. The government's here taking our equipment. They want me to shut up. Right?
Just go and have a seat, sir.
Okay, have a seat in my house, right?
Can you read?
No, I can't. I'm blind.
Can someone else read?
Okay, why don't you tell me what you're looking for? I can show you where everything is.
We'll take care of that, sir. Just go and have a seat, okay?
Okay.
Now, is that everybody that's in the house?
Where's the babies at, y'all?
We're going to sweep the house.
Okay, the babies, everybody in the house is sitting right here.
We're going to do a quick security sweep of the house, and then...
There's no point. There's nobody here.
Okay.
Go ahead. So they're attacked. They got the whole house, y'all. They got us surrounded. How many years, dear? Can I answer my phone?
No.
I can't answer my phone. All right. I can't. You won't let me?
Several weeks ago on Unwelcome Guests, we aired an adaptation of a documentary on free radio. Mbana Kantako, an operator of an unlicensed low-power FM radio station in Springfield, Illinois, was one of the broadcasters prominently featured in the documentary. Shortly after the NAB convention, Kantako's station, Human Rights Radio, was raided and shut down. A week later, two stations in Austin, Texas, were also raided. In both cases, the timing of the raids preceded a high-profile event of the ruling elites. In Springfield, a display of military aircraft, and in Austin, a meeting of the Fortune 500. V-Man of Free Radio Santa Cruz spoke with Kentaco shortly after the raid.
So I was wondering if I could just briefly get you to talk about your work in the community there in Springfield, Illinois. I know you do some programs with the young folks as well as the radio station, and you've been on the air for over 12 years now, going on 13 years of unlicensed broadcasting, and a lot of people refer to you as sort of the so-called grandfather of the micro radio movement. I was wondering if you could talk about some of the reasons that you started the radio station there in Springfield.
We started the radio station back in the 87, November 25th of 87, after spending a couple of years working in the community, you know, trying to organize some things. You know, we were suffering pretty bad, you know. And at the time we started, I think the median family income for the country was $32,000. For public housing, it was $6,000. And for the public housing project we was in, it was under $4,000. So we was about ready to go out of business as a people. So we was trying to find ways to survive. And one of the things we set out to do was to try to work with our children to, you know, try to at least prepare for a better tomorrow, you know. And, well, when we got more focused on things that were, you know, real, we saw that the system was attacking our organization. So in the summer of 87, we discussed going on the air as a means to communicating to the community, you know, what we were doing, because we were being demonized because we wasn't doing, you know, the stuff they say we should do, you know, the mindless stuff to keep you in the program. And so we came on the air in November of 87, and we used the radio again as a part of the overall program we do with the children. And through the years, it's been very key in terms of helping us educate ourselves, educate the community, and it recently starts serving as a place where we share the music that the Creator has allowed us to write, co-create here, that we use to teach the children, you know, our cultural awareness, who we are, and that we need to be about the business of, you know, getting ourselves together so we can, you know, as our elders teach us, get our reparations and leave. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I hear you there. You also used the radio to discuss many issues in the community, including some police repression that was going on in the early 90s. I was wondering if I could get you to touch upon that.
Yeah, that's really what brought out, made us really go to the station, because, you know, like in 87, they pigs had killed some brother here in town at the American Legion. They, like, a dozen of them beat him down and then put a dog on him, and they just, the people accounted, you know, they were mopping up blood when it was over with. That's how bad they beat the brother, you know, and they let him just basically drain all the blood out on the floor there.
Yeah.
And so we did a demonstration in the March of 87, April of 87. And the media, that's when the media really, you know, went after us and just tried to, you know, because we took about 400 folks down to City Hall and basically just terrorized them for a couple hours and got our point across and left, and, you know. And, but we were trying to raise awareness to the issue of police brutality, and we did. But they really started at us, so we got into the radio because of what they were doing. But our first year or so, we didn't really deal with a lot of issues related to the police, because we didn't, you know, it wasn't the target. The target was to get information out, and we just dealt with the police, or, you know. But then it got to the people came and said, hey, we got to have, you know, we want to do interviews. People want to do interviews about, you know, being beat down. And so, you know, we was the only means of communicating these messages. And the story sounded so similar, you know.
Yeah.
And nobody was any more guilty than anybody. It's just like a, it seemed like a pattern of control. It was because the stories were, so we thought, well, let's play these stories and let people see how everybody, you know, starts off in a harmless situation and they end up getting, you know, knocked down, you know. And so people start, as we play stories, more and more people start coming. Well, that was happening in like 89, 88, 89. That's when the elder Sensei Akinkaji came along and started teaching us about human rights and stuff. So we started stressing that. And, you know, being born with rights, you know, these truths that we hold self-evident, you know, those kind of rights. And so we start, you know, airing these police brutality stories, and we noticed that they started getting really brutal with people more that we knew, you know, not just people in town. And in fact, it ended up in March of 89, they killed three kids and claimed
three
one
kids.
Little brother killed two sisters and then shot himself. Well, we know better than that. Because what they said the scenario was, he shot them, rolled them up in blankets, laid them on top of each other, and then shot himself and laid down on top of them. Well, that's about as dumb as you can get, you know. And we know that didn't happen because we know him. I know him since he was a baby. And So we, when they brung his, their bodies out, we know they brung them right by us as a means of telling us that, you know, what do you think of this? We'll do this. And they introduced the black-suited mass multi-jurisdictional task force in Springfield again on that day of March of 89. And so shortly after that, the next day I found three women that witnessed that whole situation, and they saw a view that made it clear that it was a slaughter, you know. They didn't actually see inside the house, but the things that they were allowed to see made it clear that the version, for example, they saw cats all dressed in black break into the house. Well, the TV version showed blue-suited cats with badges on breaking into the house. You
yeah.
know? And they didn't. It was a Hollywood production, you know, and so we played that, and that's when they snapped, and the chief of police filed a complaint on me.
And
they visited us in April of 89 then.
They visited the radio station with agents from the FCC?
In 89.
In 89, for the first time.
Yeah, September the 6th is when we met with them, you know. We didn't know nothing then. You know, we was only new to human rights, you know, then. We hadn't been really working with it that long, the concept and how to incorporate it in our life. We were still an organization that was called the Tenants' Rights Association, see.
And
we thought it was a landlord-tenant dispute, you know what I'm saying?
Correct. Your station was WTRA, is that correct?
Yeah, that's when we came on, WTRA, W Tenants' Rights Association, back in that time. And so the guy, the same cat that eventually came, we'll talk about later on, but the cat came, we didn't know. He gave us a citation, and we went off the air. And the first night, we went down telling the people on the street. They asked us, why ain't y'all on the air? And we said, the government came and gave us a citation. And one of the brothers said, well, what else did they do? I said, nothing. He said, y'all still got the equipment? He said, yeah. We said, yeah. He said, well, then they basically just punked y'all out then, right? You got your equipment. They give you a note and say, quit being bad, and you quit being bad. So we, said, you're right. You know, we was mad at him first, you know, because, you know, he was right, but, you know, it was a hard truth to take. You know what I'm saying? And so, you know, in fact, I even told my friend, I said, you know, let's go, because I drank at the time. And I said, let's go down here and get a drink. When I come back, if this MF is still here, I'm going to kick his ass, you know. And when I got back, he was still there, and we just talked it over, and I said, man, look, you're right, you know, that's where it is. And so we took about another few days to develop a statement to come back on the air, and we came back April 17th, 89. And from the moment when they came, they also then instituted a pig patrol in the projects, you know, at that time. And so we know they brought that for us. So when we went off, that patrol really got really aggressive on the community. And so it was clear we had to come back on. And so we came back on. And when we came back on, 2 days later, they stepped up that patrol. And so we basically went at, you know, just dealt with them in the project all the way up until, 97. We stayed because we said we was going to document how they were relocating our people. And if you look in any part of this country now, African people that once lived in the inner cities are now in suburbs, you know what I'm saying?
Yes,
and
true.
Inner city is being taken over by the .com crew, you know?
That's true.
And people being kicked to the curb, they don't need us. So, you know, it's like they don't need us and they thinking about the payback too, you know what I'm saying? So they're trying to find ways to disperse us. So we thought we would document the dispersal program. And it was a ruthless dispersal program. One day we found 33 families got evicted one day alone, you know? And it was things like, you know, since the housing project ain't nothing but a concentration camp for our people, we know that. Years rent wasn't really an issue. You paid it when you felt like it, paid it when you didn't, okay? But when they started to evict folks, then it became an issue. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
With me, they stopped taking rent from me in 1992. And then they said in 96 they wanted it all, like about $5,000, you know.
Wow.
In fact, a couple times I tried to pay it in 92, I got on tape, and they called the police on me and was going to arrest me if I didn't leave the property from paying rent. But they wouldn't evict me. So, you know, I ain't no fool. It's a good place.
Yeah.
I'm doing my work here, you know. Use it for children's programs. I stayed. So finally they went through a little court thing where they evicted me because I didn't pay rent. And by then, you know, we had took another apartment up in the project anyway for a children's library, you know. The people wanted it, and we just took one. It was so many vacant. We took it in 91, really. In 92, they raided it under that Rodney King show, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
And tore it up, but we built it back, and we kept it all the way to 97 until we left. So in the end, when they evicted me, I just moved my stuff down into that apartment until, eventually my family did move out. Once we was the last family there. We did leave, which we told the people we would stay and document it, and we documented it. And here's what we, you know, we were forced to move for the dot-com crew, you know. And, of course, we got $121 from the Housing Authority in relocation assistance.
$121.
There you go. That's right. That's what we got. And you know, we had our station, so you know what they did to the other people. You know what I'm saying? And so we moved out into another apartment house on not far from the projects in 97, March of 97. And we got back on the air. In fact, we put our antenna up before we even moved in.
And changed it to Human Rights Radio from that point.
Well, we changed in February of 97, a month before we left the projects. You know, because, see, you know, most people don't know, in the time we've been on the air, we haven't had any support from any black national organization.
Right. It's all been...
I got shot at in 1991, and I called all the black national organizations for support. All of them asked me, did I fill out a police report? And I'm like, I'm
really
be talking to the police. You know what I'm saying?
Wow.
So we got off of the Black Liberation Radio thing back in February, because when we went to court with the housing, and they before they evicted me, they took all my furniture out of my apartment, set it on the curb, and then for some reason, they put it back in, but they turned it into firewood, basically.
Wow.
So I filed a grievance for, you know, reimbursement. And, it, you know, they basically told me to get lost, you know. And I never got anything. I got all of it on videotape. They just tore up my house and stuff. And then they told me I had to go anyway, you know, after they tore it up, you know. Anyhow, we moved on 6th Street. And then in December of 98, the FCC came again. And they wanted to come in. This time we told them they couldn't come in.
And it's been the same agent over the years, hasn't it?
That's right, same cat, same black cat, you know, talking this brother stuff to me, you know what I'm saying?
What's his name?
Willoford Gray.
Willoford
Gray. With a name like that, you know he caught it in school, don't you?
Yeah.
Willoford, you see? And so he wanted to take out his frustrations on me, you know, he wanted to be a Huxtable, but he don't got the money, you know? But anyway, he come back and he wanted to come in, and I told him he can't come in 98, because by then I understood he didn't have to come in, you know, if I didn't want him in with his piece of paper. So that went on, you know, he gave us another citation. That was the second one, okay? And so then in 99, we moved in February of 99 to a house because the guy we was renting from, he's kind of a cool cat, and we moved to a house that he owned, and it gave us more room for the radio.
Bigger facilities, yeah.
Yeah, and I had a grandbaby born, and I knew that I was going, you know, we were going to try to make room for that and all that. And so we moved. And so in September of 99, the same cat come again. But he didn't want to talk because, you know, he didn't want me to put him on tape. See, I put him on tape and make songs about him, so he don't like that. So this time he just basically stuffed the citation under the screen in my window as I, you know, I was trying to grab my tape recorder, but he wouldn't even stay long enough for me to do that, you know. And so leads us up to, in January 2000, we started up a second station here in our house.
Oh, really? Second unlicensed station.
There you go, yeah. We ran Human Rights Radio 2, we call it,
86.9
right. FM. And it was on the air 215 days before the raid of September 29, 2000.
And you had a court appearance on yesterday.
So. Yeah, this is an interesting thing. On the 28th, I work with children, so Thursday night we were going to get all the children together and go over to a park and just, you know, kick it, you know, let them all be together and kick it for a few, you know, a couple hours. We wasn't doing nothing. And we had it was a planned thing. So I come out the house and I was going to, I was talking to my wife about, we was looking for a grill or something. And so she says, who the hell is this showing up, coming around, this white dude coming around the house with a suit on? And so I stopped him. I said, hold up, who is you? What do you want? You know, he wanted to shake my hand. I said, no, well, who are you first? He says he's with the United States Attorney's Office.
Okay.
I said, well, it's not the neighborhood for you to be hanging out in. What do you want? You know, he's looking for me. He says he's looking for Mbana Kantako. Well, I'm not trying to tell him who I am till I find out what he want with Mbana Kantako. Well, he obviously knew who I was. So after a while, he made that, you know, I made him make that clear that he knew who I was. And he said he was at the office, and some people asked him to give me some papers. He wasn't there in official capacity. It wasn't that I had to sign for it. But when somebody else did try to take the papers, he took them from them and gave them to, you know, pushed them my way.
So your hands, okay. So he was subpoenaing you for court.
Well, I didn't find this out until I got to court. He was acting like it wasn't nothing official.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But it was Thursday night, September 28th at 5:15. Everything's closed downtown. Okay. So I say, it says it's 30 pages, calling a motion asking for a restraining order against me, filed by the FCC. It's alleging that as of September 25th, 26th, and 28th of 2000.
Of September.
Air traffic controllers at the airport here recorded in their logs 10 times that I interfered with their traffic with airplanes.
And, so, you know, tell our listeners how big your transmitters are. How many watts?
We'll put out about 15. We'll put out about 30 watts.
30 watts.
The airport's about 10 miles away.
10 miles away.
Okay. We've been on the air for that day. At that point, we had been on the air 4,247 days. If there was any problems with airplanes, communications, it wouldn't have started 3 days before, you know, 2 days. In fact, three of the complaints that were a part of the affidavit was actually a part of it after the FCC asked for the restraining order. So they was just adding on. And, you know, it's one of those quintuple moves. This government deems that if you do what they say don't do, you're a criminal. Well, we wear that badge with honor. You know what I'm saying? And what we do is we was doing the information. Well, anyhow, they claim that after 4,000 some odd days in the last week, we start interfering with airplanes. This poses a threat to the safety of the airplane passengers, you know. So it required an immediate restraining order to hold, you know. So on Friday, the 29th of September, 2000, there was a hearing going to be held at the Federal District Court. And I was supposed to be there. Well, he never let me know that I was supposed to be there. I said I would go because I wanted to be there anyway. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Yeah, but I found out at 5:15 that evening before. So we get down there, and we go through the thing at the door about my tape recorder. They won't let me take it upstairs. I tell them I need a tape recorder because I can't take notes. I'm blind. I don't have no attorney. They said, well, we'll have a transcript, but you'll have to buy it.
No way. Are you kidding me? You'll have to buy it.
Yeah. You know, I told him I got my donkey tied up outside, so let's go upstairs, you know. So the dude take me upstairs, and I tell him I want to go to suite 312 where the hearing was supposed to be, but he takes me to like a closet, basically, where nobody has any idea what I'm down there for at 8 o'clock in the morning. You know, Springfield's not that busy. After about 10 minutes in this little holding room, me and my wife, then the United States Assistant Attorney, Francis Collins, shows up and says, oh, someone came to the courtroom and said, you were looking for us. No, I said, you all were looking for me, okay? And so I said, so let's go anyway, you know. So she's going down the hall. She's trying to be friendly, you know. And I'm like, there's nothing else for us to talk about, you know. So when I get to the courtroom, it's a full-fledged hearing thing. You know, it's everything, you know, you've got a court. I had no idea all this was going on, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So pretty soon the judge runs in. It's a female judge, female prosecutor, black agent for the FCC. You see how they got the table set?
Right.
And so the FCC, the United States Attorney, I'm not even understanding that we were supposed to be in a court. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm thinking it's like a meeting.
This came out of nowhere. And
yeah, they just like bum rushed.
Determining your future here.
There you go. You know, free country, right? And so they do the all rise thing, which I don't do, because if we're all equal, I don't have to stand up for her. She didn't stand up when I came in. I'm not standing up for her, you know. And I don't do that for nobody. I don't believe in that. You know, that's not the way we've been raised. And so, anyhow, they go through the court thing, and they run it rambling on about how the immediate danger of the airport has to be considered here, and the court needs to take the safety of these innocent people in the planes, and Mr. Kentucky's political views are...
Oh, they brought up your political views.
Yeah, they said they in fact threaten the safety and well-being of the U.S. United States population. Citizens of the United States, that's what...
Is that what you say?
Yeah, what I say, what I'm about, what I represent. Basically, America couldn't have a worse type criminal in their midst. And when I show you, describe to your listeners how they came at our house, I mean, they probably ain't went after Noriega the way they came to our house. But anyhow, they went through this whole thing like I was public enemy number one, getting ready to, you know, take over the Pentagon or something, you know, with this 15-watt, you know, 25-watt transmitter. And everybody needs to know the transmitter is one sold by a company that's got certified equipment. That it wouldn't put out nothing like that. It's got all kind of harmonic protection devices off in it. There's no way it was in it. And if it was, it did it long before 4,247 nights. And why are those pilots those days on September 25th and 27th and 28th more important than all the other pilots that complain.
Well, what's happening there this weekend in Springfield?
They have the celebration of their death machines. They got their air rendezvous, you know.
The Navy air show?
Instruments of death, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
Gun bomb people that don't got slingshots, you know. They want to celebrate that kind of stuff, you know. Springfield is a tourist place, and they rely upon the population being available to satisfy the desires of the tourists.
Right.
And the population, to feel that they have to do that, have to be very ignorant. You know what I'm saying? And you know what one fly can do to a 25-gallon bowl of punch? That's what Human Rights Radio was like, you see?
Okay, so the judge gets the one.
The judge issues the order, and I get up to leave the courtroom, and the United States Attorney and the FCC agent run over to me. And basically, what they were saying, please don't make us show our fangs. And I turned to both of them, and I said, look, I'll be at home, load up your truck with thugs, and come and get the stuff. That's the only way you're going to get it. Okay? So I went home, and I called a few friends and told them what happened. And I went and took me a nap, and I got up, and I went out and sat on the porch. And they wasn't coming fast enough, so about 4 in the afternoon, I started calling them every 15 minutes. And my wife went to the store, and she said there was some fancy cat down there in a very fancy car at the store. And so I knew then that that was the guy that was going to do the scout, you know, for them. And so I got back on the radio, and I said, okay, we made your point, guys, so come on, let's make this move. And so as soon as I said that, I got up, walked toward the kitchen to get me a glass of water. I didn't get to the kitchen before my wife said, here they come. So I turned around, went back, got my tape recorder, and went to the door to greet them.
And you were still live on the air?
Yeah. By then, I stopped by the mixer, the board there, just left the mics up for the time that I could. And my daughter grabbed a video camera, and I grabbed a tape recorder. And they asked me to come out the house first, and I went out. And they basically let me know outside.
How many cars came up?
We now, as we talk to different people, there had to be at least 10 cars and at least a van around the house. Now, we don't know in terms of support, you know, crews, what they had backup. But from them came 40 to 50 agents.
40 to 50 agents from different departments.
Federal marshals, state police, county police, city police. Anybody had a squirrel rifle that Hayden and Banner can tackle could get on a Jeep and ride. They went to the bar and they loaded up and they came. And they told me on the porch they had this warrant. I said, well, hell, the transmitter's upstairs. Why don't you just go get it, you know? You all are going to have to go in the living room and sit down. So they forced my family, my wife, my daughter 21 with her two babies, one month old and 2 years old.
A month old? And how was their treatment of you?
Well, they kept us on, they moved us into the living room. And they set us on the couch until Williford Gray came in and told them to take everything in our house, basically. They took our computer.
They took your computer.
The printer. They left the mouse and the speakers. They were very cute. They took my stereo speakers. They took my stereo receiver. They took 3 VCRs. They took 4 tape players, 2 cassette, 2 CD players, and 1 CD recorder, 2 mixers, 2 microphones. They cut the cables to our antennas that are on the roof, all the way up to the roof.
And they left the antenna up, huh?
Yeah, but they cut the cables, you know. They trashed our living room, okay? They kicked my tape. They didn't take our tapes or CDs. They kicked them around the room. They kicked the shelf off of one of my stands. They had to kick it off because they had like a dozen nails that I recently put it back together. And you had to wear jackboots to kick it off, too. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So it was a good feeling, you know, like, yes, you know. For 10 minutes, 5 minutes, first 5 minutes, until the agent came in the front room, the military secured the house, ran around, you know, who's in here? And we're trying to tell them at the same time, ain't nobody in here but us and myself, my wife, my kids, and my grandkids.
And did they put everybody at gunpoint?
We were held that way for 45 minutes. We sat in the front room for a while, and then they said they got tired of us videotaping them and laughing at them, so they moved us to our bedroom, and they held us in there for another 40 minutes, 35 to 40 minutes. After they wouldn't let us make a phone call. They said if we wanted to call a friend, that was out of the question. But if we wanted to call an attorney, they would call one for us.
Okay.
I guess they see that there's probably the contradiction between an attorney being a friend.
Right.
But anyhow, when they left, after about, they came about 5:15. At 5:57, 58, they was, at 6 o'clock, they was pulling off from in front of the house, and we were allowed then to leave our bedroom. And we assessed the situation. They just trashed the living room. The room where the transmitter was in, they basically went there and just did what they felt like, you know.
Now, are you facing any kind of charges or any further court?
They're scheduled for October the 4th to confirm that they were right for what they were doing, you know what I'm saying? To talk about why they wanted such a restraining order, okay? Which I imagine, you know, at least they're going to want to do is keep everything they steal. That's just part of the territory, you know. Why take the job if you can't steal, right?
Right.
And so I imagine at least they're going to want to do that. They'll probably give me this note about, you know that unless you people understand what we want you to be thinking, you're going to catch hell again, you know, that kind of lecture. And, you know, like, it's already understood that they deem anything that my people do to restore ourselves from this we call Holocaust that they visited on us for 11 generations is going to be deemed illegal. And those of us who do anything to help our people recover from this Holocaust are going to be deemed criminal. So among us, it's a badge of honor to be called a criminal in this country. So whatever labels, whatever they want to do, that's their business. We say to the people that we've been blessed to learn a lot of communicating skills in the time we've been on the air, and none of that equipment I had the money to buy. And if the Creator allows equipment of that kind to be in my hands again, I'll be right back on the air and ain't even thinking about it.
How can people help you achieve that goal?
Well, you know, our address is 1113 North 5th Street, Springfield, Illinois, 62702. And, you know, if you got something like, you know, any kind of piece of stereo equipment that might help in a broadcast, send it forward. You know, we'll be glad to use it. We'll put it to good use. We're trench warriors. We fight in the trenches. And all we ask down here is for the equipment to fight this devil, and we're going to whoop him. We're fighting him right here in the heartland, where he tells the biggest lie in the world that, yeah, we enslaved people, but we freed them. And they know that's the biggest lie, because your listeners and everybody out there knows that when they get through, all they got at the end of the day is what a slave had. A place to stay, not the best. Food to eat, not the best. Clothes to wear, not the best. They don't have relationships. They don't have anything that matters. And everybody knows it. And so what we set out to do from the beginning was to make this boy show his fangs. Right here in Springfield, right in Lincoln Town, they proved to everybody that you can speak freely if you think what they want you to think. And you will think what they want you to think, because you will never hear nothing but what they want you to hear.
That was Mbana Kantako of Human Rights Radio in Springfield, Illinois, speaking with the V-Man of Free Radio Santa Cruz about the federal raid that shut down his station 2 weeks ago.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
My end, for my guns and my saddle will all